Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
And I'm Chris Farrell, substituting for Carrie Miller this morning. Now, the graduating class of 2016 is entering the best job market in years. I mean, we all know that. But what about people without a post-secondary degree? How bad is the job market? And what are the options for young people in their late teens and their 20s entering, trying to get a job, trying to earn an income, but without a post-secondary degree? So to learn more, we're joined by Jared Bernstein. He's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. And he also has a wonderful blog that I follow on the economy. Check it out. And Anthony Carnevale, he's research professor, director of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University. And if you go to their website, they have a lot of publications about the job market, particularly for college graduates, but all kinds of people, post-secondary education. I always check out their website. So thank you, Tony and Jared, for joining us.
My pleasure.
Thanks for inviting us.
So Jared, set the scene. What is the current scene? What is the job market like for high school graduates, young adults without a post-secondary degree?
Well, for those folks and for everybody else, the job market is much improved relative to where it was, of course, in the heart of the Great Depression. But for people with less educational attainment, they've been long at a disadvantage relative to those with higher degrees. This is both in terms of their employment opportunities and most notably in terms of their earnings. I mean, if you really want to see a significant earnings premium, meaning a boost in your wage relative to someone with less education, you have to have at least a college degree. That said, there's still considerable underemployment, even for people with college degrees, for young workers who have a college degree, but say not an advanced degree. Their underemployment rate, meaning not just those who are out of work and looking for work, but who are underemployed. They can't find enough hours as much as they'd rather be full-time, but they're part-time. That's still around 13%. That's pretty elevated. Before the recession, it was closer to 9 or 10%. So there's less slack in the job market. There's long been better earnings opportunities for people with more education. But I would say we're not really there yet in terms of a welcoming job market, especially for people with college degrees. And even worse, for those with a terminal high school degree.
Okay, so Tony, one of the things that really struck me while I was doing research for this conversation was there's this strand of commentary, and people are very adamant about this. A college degree is not worth it. You get that college degree, all you're going to have is a lot of debt. So if you don't take on that debt, have a little hustle, have a little grit, go out there, get yourself a job. And then there's usually this sort of thin gruel of jobs that might be available for people who don't have some kind of post-secondary education. So what do you think of that strand of commentary?
I think in the end it's very predictable when recessions occur, especially deep ones. Those stories come out. They're very frightening to upper-middle-class Americans who are the people who read the newspapers. So if you can scare parents into thinking that they can't pass on their middle-class status, your story's going to page one. So I think there is a those stories in the end, I think, miss a much more complicated reality, and that is that it's not so much your degree anymore, that is the level of your education, although on average that matters, but averages lie. What really matters most now is your field of study. What you take determines what you make. You can get an AA. 30% of people with two-year degrees, associate's degrees, make more than the average college degree, and there are lots of certificates, heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, for instance, that pay a lot more than the average bachelor's degree. So it's not really about going to college, not going to college. You do need post-secondary. High school only works only for about 20% of Americans, and those are almost all males.
Okay, so I want to take a call from David in Minneapolis, but first I just want to make sure I give out the number. We'd like to hear from you. So if you have a question or a comment for Tony or Jared, call us at 651-227-6000. Toll free, that's 800-242-2828. And online, it's nprnews.org/live. So, David, in Minneapolis.
Well, you basically covered, mostly what I want to say. I mean, about, there's so many people that I know, college degrees, they can't fix a leaky roof, they can't fix a leaky faucet, they can't hang a ceiling fan, they can't replace a starter or an alternator or a muffler. They're totally useless.
I, for the record, I can't do any of
those. I was just going to say, I can't do any of those things either.
Well, yeah. I mean, it just doesn't take that much. We need, the plumbing, the trades need people, and you come out of trade school and you make lots and lots of money, wind power, $75,000 a year and up if you can climb a tower and you know how to fix the generators. I mean,
so if I could speak to that.
Yes. Go ahead.
So I think that, I think the caller makes a very important point. For a long time, I think that a lot of policymakers have kind of argued that you either go to college for at least 4 years and better 6 or 8 or 10 years, or you're just pretty screwed in today's economy. Well, and I'm not sure if Tony and I agree or disagree on this point, but in fact, there is a long-term premium to going to college. So that's not a completely crazy viewpoint, but the caller is correct. There are a number of occupations that pay well above what you'd earn as simply a high school graduate, which is somewhere in the $10 to $12 an hour range. You're talking more about $18 to $20, $20 to $22 an hour if you are an established and skilled occupational in one of the fields that was just mentioned. That said, we're one way in which I think we ought to be doing more of that is through apprenticeship programs. That's widely used in Europe, and we're not seeing enough of it here, and it would be a good way to help people who may not be on that college track to find those opportunities.
Well, Tony, why aren't we seeing more of that? Because it does seem what David was talking about, that is a common theme the last couple of years, and people have been looking at Switzerland and Germany and the various apprenticeship programs there, vocational school, vocational training, but it still seems that it's on the fringes.
In the United States.
In the United States.
In the United States in 1983, with the Nation at Risk report, which was the year we all panicked over K-12 education, we essentially came to an agreement over time that we would give everybody an academic education through high school, and we threw away what we used to call vocational education. It became held in such disrepute that it had to leave town and change its name. It became career and technical education. So we've largely bought almost completely into the high school to Harvard pathway for all Americans, and it simply doesn't work, and it's not a reality that squares with the actual job structure of the economy.
So before we go to Alan, Eden Prairie, Jared, I want to ask you, when you read the commentary, particularly commentary that is influenced by Wall Street, you get this. Mm-hmm. There's this conversation. We're back at full employment, back at full employment. So, kind of, what are people complaining about? Janet Yellen's going to raise rates because we're back at full employment.
No, you make a great point. And in fact, I, as big a fan I am as Janet Yellen, who's the chairwoman of the Federal Reserve, I think raising rates right now would be a mistake, precisely because we're not at full employment. Now, the unemployment rate nationally is 5%. For younger people, it's higher than that. Even younger people with a college degree, it's about 5.5%. But the underemployment rate is still closer to 10%. And that means that there are a lot of people, it's actually about 6 million of them, who can't find enough hours. They want to be full-time workers, but they're only part-timers. And we're only starting to see some wage gains, suggesting that there's a bit more pressure in the job market. Economists don't really have a good beat on the number of the unemployment. It actually corresponds to full employment. It turns out that number is very hard to estimate these days. So you kind of have to look at inflation and wage growth, basically judge whether the economy is at capacity. And I'm telling you it's not. And I'll bet you that resonates with a lot of our callers who kind of know what the economy looks like on the ground.
Okay, so Tony, people go out there, they want to get a certificate, they're interested in some of these alternative jobs, but do employers take these certificates seriously?
Well, the one way to know the employer's view on the value of skill is to see whether they hire people or not and what they pay them. And in the end, the answer here is yes, depending on your field of study. So that if you're in a technical field, and this holds throughout all levels of education, whether it's high school or a two-year college or a four-year college or a technical institute, you'll do quite well. I mean, what really matters now, the differences among people are less about which college they go to. That matters less and less. What really matters is which program they take. So even among bachelor's degrees, somebody who studies petroleum engineering will make $128,000 a year. Somebody who studies early childhood education will make $30,000 a year. Now, there's social value in the early childhood education, but the market, the employers don't recognize it. So there is, in technical fields at the sub-baccalaureate level, especially the obvious ones, computers and anything to do with electronics, will pay very well, and employers find huge shortages among those people.
So we're going to go to Lisa in Eden Prairie, and she has what I think is a really important twist on this certificate question. Lisa?
Yes, hello.
So what
my
are your,
question yeah. is, so for someone in middle age looking for a second career, are employers going to look at us if we get those certificates? I've got a two-year degree from the 80s.
Right. So, you know, Tony, there are more and more people who are they're aging. They're looking to certificates in order to revive their careers, regenerate their careers, launch their careers. What about the older worker?
In the end, the best bet always for somebody who wants to get valuable education fast is to go after something bite-sized. Certificates are ideal in that case, but you have to be very careful. When we look at certificates, and they are now the largest award given in the education system after high school, about half of them have value of more than 20% per annum over a high school degree. Half of them don't. So what you need to know is you've got to ask the institution what happened to all the people who got that certificate before you. But if you want something that is fast and efficient and valuable, certificates are the way to go, which is why they're growing so much.
And, well, we're sticking in Eden Prairie. And, Jared, I'm going to direct this question to you because Al's going to be talking about the minimum wage. And I know, Jared, you've been deeply involved in that issue.
Sure. Yeah, good morning, guys. Thanks. Great conversation. Yeah, I just wanted to, before that, I just wanted to do one little quick comment, kind of taking off into other one. I'm above the 50-year mark now, and I hear so many people over 50 are saying, you know, especially males, I'm pretty much, if I'm out, I'm pretty much done. So you might want to talk about that a little bit more. But my question really is about minimum wage. If I know there's a lot of agitation right now to get the minimum wage to $15 an hour, which, you know, that's all good and fine, I guess. But here's the thing. Let's say you have these people with certificates or even, you know, the baccalaureate that's not in high demand, and they come out and they're making, you know, $18 an hour, let's say, $19 an hour. What's going to be the kind of the knock-on effect of this? Because I'm thinking, okay, I just spent 4 years busting my butt. I got out of school, and I'm making the same wage as a person who is, you know, maybe doing cleaning work or maybe working McDonald's or, you know, bussing tables or something. It's like,
No. Wait
a minute.
No, it's a great question, and it's one that maybe isn't asked enough. So I think you've really hit on something important. For one thing, we know that employers do like to keep what economists call the relative wage structure in place, meaning precisely what you said. If I think I'm someone who, by dint of my educational attainment, whether it's a certificate or a graduate degree, should be doing X better than a minimum wage worker, when a minimum wage goes up, I think my pay should go up too. Now, one thing to keep in mind is that these $15 an hour proposals have long phase-ins. So when they've been put in place in Seattle and San Francisco, New York State has talked about it, typically you don't get to the 15 till 2020, 2022 in some cases. So that gives more time for that differential you're describing to grow. I think what you're describing is one reason why I don't think the 15 works everywhere. I'm not sure that it would be a good national minimum wage floor, at least absent a very long phase-in. I do think that kind of spillover effect has to be accounted for.
And are you seeing any impact, or are we seeing any impact of the minimum wage on less skilled workers, which is always the big fear?
Well, you know, when you ask a question about the minimum wage, you kind of have to say, which minimum wage are you talking about? Because there are literally dozens of them across the country. What we have seen consistently is that moderate increases in the minimum wage have not had the predicted job loss effects that opponents claim. Or certainly you could very much substantiate the claim that there have been many more beneficiaries than anyone who's been hurt by those kinds of increases. That said, 15 is not really in that moderate space, so it takes us kind of out of the sample that we're used to. As it's been phasing in Seattle so far, we haven't seen too many problems on the employment side at all. So far, so good, but we're going to have to watch that carefully.
Tony, why is it that employers keep raising their educational requirements? I mean, is that a reflection of we went through a weak economy and therefore employers can say we want to hire someone to clean our floors, and before we hire you, you have to demonstrate that you can play Bach, and not only play Bach, but build the piano out of sustainable materials, and then as the economy gets better, they drop these sustainable materials, you no longer have to play Bach, and eventually they just hire you to do some cleaning.
We know that since 1983, that is at the end of the 80-81 recession, which was the last great recession before the one we just had, that the American economy went into a phase of massive restructuring after we killed off inflation. And what occurred then that is really remarkable is that the value of skill started to go up very rapidly. And now in America, we measure that oftentimes by the value of education. There were a lot of very skilled workers in the 70s who could run a drill press or do a whole lot of other things, but they didn't learn that in school. What happened in after the 80s was that school-based kinds of learning, including occupational preparation, especially at the post-secondary level, increased enormously in value, and earnings differences began to rise dramatically. And we now know, David Oder and other economists have shown us, that about 80% of the increase in inequality in the American income distribution is due to differences in access to post-secondary education and training. So we went from an economy where skill levels were essentially high school to an economy where skill levels were high school plus. I mean, people argue about whether it's high school plus 1 year or 2 years and so on. But it's essentially high school plus, except for a small share of males who can still work and learn on the job from day one in the old blue-collar economy or what's left of it.
So, Jared, this is a little bit of a side twist, but this word skill. So I used to be a merchant seaman, and I worked in the engine rooms of merchant ships. And we would be at sea, and something would break, and you just watch these engineers and able-bodied seamen, and they could machine in a shop what needed to be done to keep the ship going. I mean, it was incredible skill. And yet, oftentimes I feel in the way economists discuss skill, that's not really a skill. If they were able to use a computer, they would be highly skilled. But being able to machine something in a storm in a little corner of an engine room, that's not really a skill.
Yeah, economists are terrible in that perspective. I mean, I'm much more where you are, as intimated by your question. There are a wide variety of skilled people who don't have a college degree. And for the record, there's lots of people with college degrees who don't seem to have all that many skills.
the caller earlier.
the earlier caller pointed out. So I think you have to be much more granular in the way you look at this. And I also would disagree with Tony here that somehow you can explain 80% of inequality by just referencing education or skill, the increase in inequality. The factors that go into that are much more complicated. They have to do with trade, the decline of the minimum wage, unions losing ground, the fact that the unemployment rate has been too high for too long. That said, there are clearly premiums, that is, employers who are looking for people who can do specific things and do it well, and they can make serious money. But those people don't necessarily have a college degree or an advanced degree. Many of them do, and many of them will. But as we've said earlier, there are still occupations within this economy that call for skilled people who don't necessarily have a particular, don't have a degree from an Ivy League school.
Tony, do you agree, disagree?
Oh, sure. I mean, in the end, we're talking about a skill-biased economy, and that is what's really driven much of the change in individual fortunes since the 80s. In the 70s, almost two-thirds of us had high school degrees or less who were working, and most everybody did fine. If you got a good job at Chrysler and you're in the union, you did better than fine, did better than college graduates did. And at that time, the wage premium for college was going down. But after 83, it went up and continued to climb for quite a while and still remains high, so that we've got a wage premium that's over 80% for college versus high school now and is held up over this recession. So that there is a there is an issue about how everybody feels about that top 1%, the really rich people, the filthy rich people. But however you feel about that, the real issue among the other 99% is skill level and their ability to translate skill into earnings.
Well, both of you mentioned the word unions, and that's a topic Mary in Minneapolis wants to bring up. Mary?
Yeah, I'm not hearing anything at all about unions. Not too long ago on Channel 2, they had a program, and they said in the late 40s, when we were at the point when we had the highest number of people who were unionized in the United States, we had the most stable economy, we had the best economy, people were doing well, they were living relatively good lives. Now, I've done union organizing, I've been on a negotiating committee, I have been a steward. Yeah, it's a pain in the ass to try and get people out of work if they're not doing the job. There is a process.
Right.
But they also have to go through a period of time when they are on probation to prove that they can, in fact, do that job. And I wish people would take a look again at unions, because they did do some really good things for people. And it certainly could help some folks who can't afford to go and get these, get even maybe the two-year degrees you're talking about.
Yeah, so,
but if they were hired and they could prove they could do the job, they had the job.
They got it, Jared?
Well, our caller brings up many really great and important points, and they are relevant to much of our discussion so far. I just mentioned unions a minute ago, and really what I was talking about was this idea of bargaining power. One of the reasons we have so much inequality isn't because of skills or education, but it's because workers who are no longer represented by unions have far less ability to bargain. There's very little clout in terms of going to bat for what most people would consider their fair share of the productivity they're helping to generate. And it's one reason we've seen at the macroeconomic scale a huge divergence between productivity growth and median compensation. So the caller is absolutely correct. We also mentioned earlier apprenticeships, which is a nice way for, I think a proven way for workers to find their ways into skilled occupations that can put someone solidly in the middle class. Unions have long been associated with those kinds of programs as well. So the fact that the union coverage in the private sector is now something like 6 or 7% is a significant problem. It's one of the reasons why I emphasize the importance of very low unemployment, because that's another way to help give workers some more bargaining clout.
Right, because employers have to, well, they have to negotiate with their workers in some sense, because otherwise they can leave.
Otherwise, they'll be leaving. You know, if you're only if the job market is tight enough that if you don't hire someone, you're leaving profitability on the table, that gives the worker a bit more bargaining clout.
So, Tony, we got an email in here, and this is something that I've seen a lot. And she's describing herself mid-career transition, and she found that one big barrier is that she's not used to, as an older worker, dealing with keywords and the filters that are used to sift through potential hires. And there was a book written, I think, a couple of years ago by Peter Capella, who's at the Wharton School, and he did this famous one about Raytheon, I believe it was. And they had 28,000 applications for an engineering job, and they were all rejected. But it turns out Raytheon had a unique term to describe this particular job.
So in the end, the process of finding a job is really much more difficult, especially for people who don't have one, or even more so for people who are new in the labor market, let's say a student who just graduates. 8 out of 10 people who get hired are people who are already working. That is, it's rare for an employer to reach either into the unemployment line or to fresh new graduates unless they have to. Most of their hiring is done from within. Most jobs go to people who are already on the job and then people who have very similar skills in similar industries. So even breaking in with high skill, fresh with a degree and so on, is difficult. And more that is done through data systems, not through face-to-face hiring. And the process of getting to the interview
right.
is very difficult. Now, Jared's solution for this is mine as well, and that is if we could jack up demand a bit and have more jobs available, employers would be looking much, much further and much, much harder at people they don't customarily entertain as possible employees.
Well, I want to pick up on this because one of the things that I've noticed is in a conversation, if I mention to someone the importance of full employment, just an economy where, you know, employers are looking for workers, that's a good economy. And people kind of look at me like I have a hole in my head or maybe I'm, you know, missing a couple of lobes there about full employment because they kind of go, we can't have full employment and anyway, we're going to have inflation.
Oh, jeez. No. That, I mean,
but, so imagine you come across this a lot.
Well, you know, I mean, in fact, we were just talking about the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is talking about raising interest rates because they're worried that if the job market gets too tight, it's going to lead to faster inflation. And in fact, there is a historical correlation, so that's not a crazy concern, but you simply can't cast it that broadly. If you go back to the last time the economy was really at full employment, very much describing the scenario that Tony just outlined, where you had employers really bidding up their compensation offers to get and keep the workers they needed, inflation was tame. It wasn't going, it wasn't accelerating. It was at a reasonable level. And in fact, the Federal Reserve has been missing their inflation target on the downside for year after year after year. So this idea that full employment or even wage increases are necessarily correlated with high and spiraling inflation is just empirically wrong. And if we really believe that, we'll never get to full employment. And a lot of working people will have a big problem. Remember, I don't think this statistic has come up in this discussion yet, but about two-thirds, maybe it's 70% of the workforce now, especially if you look at the total workforce, not
right.
just young people, about two-thirds, 70% do not have a college degree.
Right.
So we can't simply come up with a solution that's for people with college or more.
So, and Tony, speak for that 70%, whatever age. How would you recommend that they think about the kind of training that they need, getting the jobs, because there's always this issue of we don't really know what the jobs are going to be in the future?
Well, we do know to some extent what the jobs are now. That is, what people really cope with in their real lives is the job they know about. And in that case, the best way to get there is to figure out what the job available is and what the skills required are to get it and then to go get them. We don't give people much of any help in doing that. We're gradually getting there. The Obama administration dropped about $760 million on information systems that tie programs that you can get at post-secondary institutions, profit for not-for-profit, and a variety of other kinds of suppliers that will tell you what happened to all the other people in your program. And if you're lucky enough to be in one of the states where this information is not only available but gets shown to people and used, that is the best way to do this, is to find the job, measure your own skill against it, see what the gap is, fill the gap, but be sure that the job is there and know what it pays relative to what it's going to cost you. So it's a different vision of American education than one we've had for so many years, which was basically sort of high school to Harvard, where school is about going somewhere where you learn ever higher levels of abstraction until you can't stand it anymore, and then you go get a job.
Okay, so I'm going to ask each of you to be the job czar for the year. You're the job czar. You can, and you have enormous power. This is a czar with power. And so, Tony, what would you really like to see? What change would you like to see that you believe would really reach out and help the young worker who does not have a college degree?
I would like to see the an end to what has been, I think, a 30-year experiment that's has become too much of a good thing, which is that we provide more and more abstract academic education in high school, and that whole movement has crashed on the shoals of Algebra 2, so that there are more and more young people in high schools who simply don't make it, either through high school or on to college. I think that I would call a halt to all the math. I think there's too much math. That in the end, we've built a system where we've created a lot of academic hurdles that keep people from learning things that will actually teach them to take can-do jobs. You know, Algebra 2 is something everybody's got to get through to go through high school and to get to college, but is probably necessary in 10% of the jobs and probably necessary in more like 25% of college majors, but that's about it. So I'd start there, and secondly, that any education and training, including that which occurs in high school and in post-secondary institutions, that those would be tightly tied to data that shows you, if you take this program, here's much how much everybody else, whether people got a job when they took it, how much it cost, and whether the cost was worse, the increase in earnings they attained, and whether or not they're working in field, and that we regulate the post-secondary system that way going forward.
And Jared, so you get the bizarre.
First of all, I like the experiment. Let's give it a shot. secondly, two things. First, there are young people of the type you describe who face real barriers to higher education. Maybe they grew up in a neighborhood where that just wasn't available. Their parents didn't go to school. It's just not part of their reality, and they can't afford it. I'd make sure that if someone has the potential to really get through a rigorous higher education experience, that they were able to do so. So I'd take down those barriers. Secondly, though, for those who don't fit that category, I would ensure that the job market was tight enough such that employers really were chasing workers versus the other way around. And that involves Federal Reserve policy, as we discussed, but fiscal policy and trade policy as well. Those are other shows for our radio hour here, but those are important as well. And then finally, there are neighborhoods in this country that are well known as job deserts. I don't care how smart or skilled you are. You're stuck there. You can't get a job because there simply isn't enough labor demand. In those neighborhoods, I would directly create jobs and apprenticeship experiences to get those folks a real bridge into the labor market.
Well, thank you very much. And I think the thing I would add to it is whenever we're talking about jobs, there's always a sense that people are going to get something, some skill, and then it's one job for the rest of their life. And for most people, apprenticeship programs, what is it, 50% of German apprenticeships go on to some kind of additional education. So I guess that I would also toss in there. But we have run out of time, speaking of time. And thank you very much. We've been joined both are in Washington, D.C. Tony Carnevale, he's research professor and director of the Center on Education and the Workforce at Georgetown University. And Jared Bernstein is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.